Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is veteran science journalist Deborah McKenzie. Deborah has been covering emerging diseases for more than 30 years as a science journalist for outlets like New Scientist magazine. She's been reporting on COVID-19 from the start, was among the first journalists to suggest that it could become a pandemic. From SARS to rabies and Ebola to AIDS, she's been on the front line in reporting on how pandemics form, why they spread, and how to stop them throughout her entire career. With the accumulated knowledge of our failings and a wealth of expert opinions, Deborah charts a forward path for protecting humanity from even worse threats. It's all in her new book called COVID, The Pandemic That Never Should Have Happened and How to Stop the Next One. Deborah McKenzie, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Pleased to be here.
Deborah, if you could start with telling us about New Scientist magazine and I've looked up all of your articles. You're very prolific in the magazine. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, I do my PhD work in the States, actually, and then decided that I kind of wanted to do something else with the rest of my life. And I sort of thought, well, you know, communicating science to the public is probably a good thing, just like what you do, except this was back in the 80s. And I just started writing for New Scientist, I struck a vein. I discovered that I really loved it, mostly doing news pieces, and it was always very exciting and interesting.
Considering that you have covered pandemics for a very long time, can you give us sort of the main differences that you have seen with COVID-19, or are we really just cycling through another pandemic that's very similar to SARS or Ebola?
Well, the thing is that none of those were really pandemic. What I've covered for a long time is infectious disease. And scientists who study infectious disease have been worried about pandemics for a while because we've just set ourselves up in a situation as a society where we're really vulnerable to them. I've seen some near misses. I've seen a pandemic back in 2009 of swine flu, you may recall. People thought was just kind of a waste of time and really mild, and it wasn't really. A lot of people died. But, you know, we had been so worried about a much more severe kind of flu happening to us that everybody went, oh, well, that's a pandemic. And we actually dropped a lot of our guard at that time and rolled back some of the preparations we'd made. It's not the sort of thing we're good at preparing for. It's a kind of a, we don't know when it's going to happen at any given time. It's a high probability that it will happen sometime, but it's a low probability that it'll happen at any given time. And we don't know how bad it's going to be. And when we need to save money, we just don't. So that's what I've been seeing through all the years that I've been covering this. Scientists discovering virus after virus and going, oh, hey, this could be bad. And then, you know, the preparation really not quite following through.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Deborah McKenzie. She has written the first book about COVID-19, the pandemic that never should have happened, and how to stop the next one. Deborah, I recently watched the Bill Gates 2015 video on the bullets that we dodged during the Ebola outbreak in the three Western countries in the continent of Africa. And it was absolutely fascinating. It certainly got my attention. It didn't get any countries' attention for the most part. Do you think we've learned our lesson? So what I was saying is that I recently watched the Bill Gates 2000 video on the bullets that we dodged during the Ebola outbreak. Do you think we've learned our lesson this time?
Well, we did learn some lessons from the Ebola outbreak. The thing is that Ebola is a scary disease because it's such a death rate. And it was actually starting to evolve a bit to adapt to us during that, by far the biggest outbreak we've ever had of that virus. So that was a scary event. The thing with Ebola is that it doesn't spread until you see symptoms. And, of course, as we all know now, the thing with COVID-19 is it spreads before there are symptoms. And it's very, very difficult to stop a virus like that. But what we learned from Ebola was that we really need to get our act together on producing vaccines for things that are not yet a problem, but maybe one in the future. We had a vaccine for Ebola that turned out to work really well, but it took us pretty much until that pandemic had been contained by the WHO and its collaborators finally getting together and using quarantine and contact tracing to really stop that epidemic. It took until then to get the vaccine that scientists had worked on in a state where we could actually start administering it to people. We discovered it worked, but, you know, it took way too long. So as a result of that, we actually set up a global coalition of public and private entities, vaccine companies, governments, various people who are working on vaccines for various things because companies can't do it if the disease has not happened yet and therefore there's not a market to sell the vaccine into. Companies are set up so they have to do that. So we needed an alternative structure to come up with vaccines that, you know, for work for diseases that weren't here yet, you know, emerging diseases. And that's where a lot of the vaccines, well, a number of the vaccines for COVID-19 are being developed. It's also where vaccines for things like the virus, you know, and other potential threats are being developed. That did come out of the Ebola experience. So that was a good thing.
You know, there's a lot of rhetoric out there over the last 3.5 months. There have been so many, interviews and talking heads on TV and on radio that really weren't qualified to be talking about COVID-19, and there's a lot of different conspiracy theories out there. One question that I have is, because I've heard so many different reports on this, but when do you believe that COVID-19 first hit the shores of the United States?
Well, the official case, first case, was, of course, the 20th of January, but it happened that a close family member of mine is working in L.A., and her boyfriend got deathly ill on the 9th of January and, strangely enough, lost his sense of taste and had all the other symptoms that we're all very familiar with now. And for my money, that was COVID. And it would surprise me if he didn't. There's so much travel back and forth to China between the Western states and certainly California and China. I mean, there are direct flights to Wuhan, aren't there? You know, it would be really strange if there hadn't been a case. We just weren't watching closely enough. Indeed, you know, the Chinese are very sensitized to this, having had SARS happen to them. It broke out in 2002 and then went global in 2003 and almost went pandemic. It took a very concerted and very, you know, stringent worldwide effort to sort of beat it back. But, they were sensitized to undiagnosable pneumonia. They noticed when this happened. They noticed when they had a cluster of cases, but it took them a few weeks too. They even had special, you know, systems set up to sort of do surveillance for infections like this, because, you know, they've also got a couple of strains of bird flu that are worrying, and they keep a close eye on them. And, you know, we think the first case of COVID-19 in China was like around the 17th of November. That fits the genetic. And they didn't really recognize a cluster, as far as we know, until later on in December. So, you know, we've got to all improve our ability to detect these things. I think we really need to work on that. That's the one take-home lesson from this pandemic, should be the increased need for very good, very transparent global surveillance.
So you talk about developing the ability to detect, and we failed on that. I think you were talking to you in France this morning, but I believe you do most of your work in the UK. Is that right?
No, I'm based in France. I was based in Brussels until just recently, but I moved down here.
Okay,
My husband's got a job in Geneva, so.
Yeah. Oh, lucky you. This sounds like a great life. Although not recently, not in the last few months. I'm glad that I haven't been in Europe. But, you know, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about how things are opening or not there. I know that various countries are treating it very differently, and whether or not they're allowing international travelers just from the other European countries in at this point. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, it's all a bit of a mess. Family like ours, it's very international. My daughter locked down here with me, left L.A. and came here. Now she's wondering when she's going to be able to get back into the States. My other daughter is in London. Britain just slapped a 14-day quarantine on anyone coming in from outside, despite the fact that Britain has got a higher rate of infection than virtually anywhere else. Anyone who comes into the country is probably coming from a place that's got a lower rate of infection than Britain. So why they have to be quarantined, I'm not entirely sure. There's been a lot of people, a lot of scientific experts sort of question this policy. But, you know, who knows when I'm going to see my other daughter again. France has done a good job, but we're living in a border town. I mean, you know, to get to a hospital if I should fall ill with this thing. And, you know, I'm old enough to be in a risk group. You know, I have to cross the border to a hospital in Geneva. We understand that this is going to be the case, but, you know, and they just opened the border again. But, you know, we've been worried about that the whole time. Meanwhile, though, France has really done a lockdown. We needed a piece of paper that we signed and stated our reason for leaving the house. There were policemen out in the street outside stopping people saying, where are you going? If they were going for their one daily walk or walking the dog or going to the grocery store, that was okay. Otherwise, they got sent home. And, you know, and people who did this repeatedly were fine. They've really enforced it. And frankly, that worked. Next door in Geneva, they've got a seropositivity rate. Like, the number of people who've had the infection and now have antibodies is about 11% of the population. I think in France, they haven't been doing terribly. Actually, they haven't been doing an updated seropositivity survey. But in a lot of other countries in Europe, it's more like 5%. Switzerland didn't lock down anything like as stringently as France did. And as a result, they had more cases of the virus. I mean, it's really amazing how everybody has done things differently. I think I was lucky to be in France.
Yeah. We have a big resurgence here in Utah over the last couple of weeks. And that resurgence is sort of starting to plateau, but it's hard to call it a trend because it's just been in the last handful of days that it's kind of seems to have plateaued. But in terms of spikes, and I know you've seen all this in the United States, all the states that are experiencing spikes and resurgence, and what would you say about that in terms of how that compares to European countries?
Well, the thing is that states are a bit different from European countries. I mean, European countries kind of did it more divergently. We differ from each other more than you might expect in the European Union. We all have different policies. But we also shut our borders, and you can't shut your state borders. Right. So, you know, if you've got a really good lockdown policy happening in one state and almost nothing happening in the state next door, and you're going to have people carrying, they're going to have a higher rate of infection in the state with almost nothing happening, and those people are going to come into a state with a really good lockdown policy. You know, I had a policeman outside the door saying, stop walking around, go home, and we had a very low rate of cases in our part of the country. You can't do that. You know, you can have somebody on the border between Utah and any of the states next door, so you can't cross into Utah. There's been problems enough with some Indian nations saying you can't cross our reservation because we want to keep this infection out, even though they apparently have the right to. States don't. So when you're all doing things differently, as you must be aware, you know, differences in policy make it very difficult to make whatever you decide to do in your state stick, because people carry this virus and they're just moving around.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Deborah McKenzie. She's written COVID-19, the pandemic that never should have happened, and how to stop the next one. On your radar is Nipah, N-I-P-A-H. Can you talk to us about that and why we should be worried, maybe?
Well, there's a lot of viruses that the virologists I talk to and the epidemiologists are worried about. Nipah has been getting a lot of attention lately because it seems to be starting to become capable of human-to-human spread, and that's the worrying thing. Most of the recent viruses that cause trouble, COVID-19 itself, Ebola, all just from animals. And what often happens when a virus jumps to humans from animals is it can't quite get the hang of the immune system. It can make us be sick, but it can't really find its way to the exits and get into another human. And so often it's a dead-end infection. For example, there's several kinds of bird flu that have been causing concern for quite some time. They've never quite learned how to transmit from one human to another. As long as they don't do that, they're not going to go pandemic. But the thing with Nipah is that it's got a very high death rate, and it seems to be starting to be able to spread. And worryingly, not just but in respiratory droplets from COVID-19, that's a difficult one. A scientist I was talking to about COVID really opened my eyes. And he said, well, look, you know, something that spreads in feces, for example, like polio, you know, we can largely take care of that by having good sanitation. Something that spreads in body fluids, like AIDS, we can deal with that by changing our behavior.
Ebola, similarly. Something that spreads in a respiratory droplet, you know, directly, you know, from through the air, is really hard because no one can stop inhaling, you know?
Yeah.
You can control excrement, you can control body fluid, you can't control breathing. It's really hard. And here in France, we've all been good about wearing masks, but, you know, it's we're all pretty much aware that it's you know, when I wear a mask, it's so I'm letting everyone else know, okay, if I happen to be sick and don't know it, I'm not going to infect you. It's not because it's going to protect me, because, you know, the protective ability of a mask, it's something, but it's not absolute.
Deborah, we're having a little trouble understanding you. Are you on a speakerphone by any chance?
No, I'm on my mobile, and I'm speaking right into it, and you're perfectly clear.
Okay, good.
My left line's completely dead, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
No idea why.
There's been a lot of talk about the organization, the World Health Organization. What role do you think they play? And they've taken some heat. Do they deserve any of it?
Well, they don't deserve some of the heat they've been getting. The trouble is that the WHO is basically put in an impossible position. It's got to sort of lead the international response to a pandemic. It's got to get countries to be open and honest about infections on their territory, which they are required to do by a treaty that we all signed up, you know, states did, you know, like everyone did, and the WHO runs it. It's called the International Health Regulations. We're supposed to tell everybody about any outbreaks on our territory that might threaten other countries. But now when COVID-19 happened, yeah, China told the WHO when it saw that there was this cluster of undiagnosed pneumonia in Wuhan, but for a few weeks it insisted that this wasn't spreading between people, and the doctors knew better. You can speculate as to why it might have done that. The WHO has been criticized for not having somehow done something to change that. What was it supposed to do? It has no powers. The countries run the WHO. The member states are the people with the power, and they have made sure that all of the international health regulations do not in any way challenge the sovereignty of individual member states. If somebody has an outbreak, the WHO might say, yeah, I've read your report on it. I don't actually believe it's not spreading from person to person. I'm going to come and inspect and see what it's really doing. You know, the WHO can't do that. You know, it's up to the member state, and if they don't want to say anything about it, the WHO has no choice but to be polite and use diplomacy and try and get the truth out. It's member states themselves have kept it from having the power to go in and really say, look, on behalf of the other countries who are at risk of this outbreak you're having, I'm going to come in and inspect this and verify that, you know, what you're saying is right and that you've got this under control. We can do that under the treaty regulating chemical weapons or regulating nuclear materials, but we can't do it under the treaty regulating infectious disease. And yet it's so obvious that we're all at risk from it. I think if we change anything as a result of this experience, it's going to have to be that. But, you know, don't blame the WHO, because they can only do what the member states themselves have been empowered to do. And that's not enough.
So with that in mind, Deborah, what would the WHO have done had it had more power in the early days of COVID with China, for example, in the Wuhan province, that didn't get done?
Well, you know, like China said, look, it's not spreading person to person. And the WHO said, well, good. I hope that keeps up, because it's kind of worrying if it doesn't. But, you know, epidemiologists around the world were saying, look, case numbers are going up awful fast for a virus that doesn't spread. We're kind of suspicious of this. And, you know, if that happened, for example, if this is a chemical weapon, and they said, no, we're not a chemical weapon. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is like the WHO, an international organization based on a treaty, could say, okay, we're going to come in and inspect. And you know, all the countries that belong to that treaty, okay, you can do that. You know, because we'd like to know if our neighbors have chemical weapons. We're going to say we don't. You can come and inspect us. Make sure we're telling the truth. We'd like our neighbors subjected to the same rule. We'll all feel safer that way. You know, it's a good treaty, and it works pretty well. We don't have that for disease. I would like to see a world where the WHO could have gone, that's really great, it's not spreading human to human, but, you know, our delegation to talk to your doctors and get some samples and look a bit more carefully at this virus, will be there on the next flight. And yeah. You know, and no country, not China, not the States, not anybody, gets to say no to that. I think that would make everyone a lot safer. I think it would be in everyone's interest.
Absolutely. Can you put to rest for us, or, you know, really what the source of COVID was, or the coronavirus? I think that there are some theories that are maybe somewhat believable. There are conspiracy theories. There are this is what we know today theories that may change tomorrow or next week. But what do we really know about the source?
We really know it came from bats, probably horseshoe bats, little insectivorous bats, much like some of the ones that live in the States. And it could very well have got out through, it might have been that market. There's some question as to whether it was. But bats and bat pests are sold on markets in China. And, you know, they're saying now, well, they were studying it at this high containment lab in Wuhan. Maybe it escaped from that. Well, those scientists are trying to warn us about these viruses. You know, they were publishing papers in 2013 saying this thing poses a pandemic threat. It's kind of unfair to blame them. It might have escaped from a lab, and if it did, you know, there will probably be records that will tell us, and there should be a transparent international investigation. That would be in everyone's interest. But look, you know, there are traditional Chinese medications made out of, not to put the final point on it, bat feces. Which, you know, involves the eye, where there are a lot of receptors for this virus. The virus is found in bat droppings. You know, I don't think we need to postulate escape from a lab if we've got a local custom where people are exposing their eyes to bat droppings, you know, which potentially have the virus in them. And the bat lives locally. They discovered that people in an area where there were a lot of these bats we're actually getting infected with these viruses occasionally. Somebody might have picked it up because they visited a bat cave and then just passed human to human to someone in Wuhan. I mean, you know, there's a lot of ways that this virus could have gotten into people. We know for sure that it was in bats, and we know for sure that there's a team of scientists in that lab that have been working hard for many years to warn people about it and to understand those viruses. I mean, it's a little unfair to attack them.
Absolutely. Well, Deborah McKenzie, a veteran science journalist who has written the first book to be published on COVID-19. The book is COVID-19, the pandemic that never should have happened and how to stop the next one. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We appreciate you being here. Thank you.
My pleasure, entirely.